Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show with me, Robert Bound. The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is the latest film by the Coen brothers, the duo behind the likes of Fargo, No Country for Old Men, and most recently, Hail Caesar. The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is an anthology of short stories all set in the Wild West, featuring Liam Neeson, James Franco and Tom Waits as gunslinging cowboys, hustlers and haggard prospectors. It was originally rumoured to be a TV series for Netflix, but has ended up as a very beautiful series of vignettes bundled into one feature-length film for the streaming service, but also a bit on general release. To discuss it with me today, I'll be joined by the editor of Empire magazine, Terry White, and film critic for the Daily Telegraph, Tim Roby.
I'm Buster. Buster Scruggs.
You're shooting iron work.
Appears to do, yes.
Let's go into the beauty of this thing. This is kind of an old-fashioned cliche of the West. We open up with a storybook, and each with colour plates, I think, as it puts it. And we're very much in a kind of old-fashioned boy's own world of the Wild West. But let's take first the idea of whether it's a TV show or a film. Terry, maybe you can kick us off. Does this feel like vignettes squashed together to make a film, or what territory are we?
It's a grey area. The Coen themselves claimed that it definitely was never intended to be a TV series, that that was not true, that they always had it in mind as a feature film. This is 25 years in the making. They've been writing these stories for a quarter of a decade, which I think is phenomenal. For me, it hangs together as a feature film, as you say, a series of six vignettes. However, it does share DNA with other anthology series, such as Black Mirror, Tales of the Unexpected, those kind of constructs of television where it was really innovative at the time, but this is cinematic in scale and scope. For me, this has to be seen on a big screen, if you can in fact get to see it on a big screen. Obviously limited release. It is, for me, it defines and inhabits everything that we believe cinema is. And I believe that their storytelling intention was to make a film, and I think that's what they've delivered upon.
I watched this on Netflix. I've clearly been an ignoramus, according to Terry, Tim. This is obviously, it looks very beautiful in the corner of the room, but it surely should be bigger. Is this a bit of a missed trick that actually people should be led in the direction of the silver screen rather than a small one?
I would say if at all possible is the answer to that, and on the biggest screen available to you. I was lucky to see it during the London Film Festival, so I did get to see it on the big screen. And I've been re-watching it and actually really enjoying the Netflix experience of being able to pause, because there are moments in this film, like for instance when the storybook opens, as you say, when there's this prose on the page, which on the big screen you won't be able to catch. It's like there for less than a second. You can pause and you can read what the Coens have set down in between each of these stories. Actually, not all of them are original stories. One of them is a Jack London adaptation that we're going to talk about. So I've been quite enjoying that. I do think it has a fluidity, though, that works, and the momentum of it and the structure of it as a six-story film works very well, and it's very carefully sequenced so that the kind of tone shifts in deliberate ways between the stories. So I think it would be a bit of a shame to break it up into watch one episode a night sort of thing. I think you really want to kind of put yourself in front of it for 2 hours 20 or whatever it is, because I feel as though it takes certain turns, and it's quite a morbid film, but there are moments where surprises are unleashed, which depend in a way on what you're expecting from the previous episodes, I think.
Visually, I set this up at the beginning by saying we're in a very beautiful place, that a lot of this beautiful cinematography might be wasted on the small screen. Terry, can you paint us a picture of where we are? Are we in a sort of Sam Peckinpah universe? Are we in a classic Western universe? Because obviously there are sort of Western cliches that they're using, but they're sort of upending in kind of classic Coen style perhaps here as well.
They are, and that's really important, is what they're seeking to do, which is to subvert, to really take those tropes, those conventions, and upend them over and over and over again. I think they do that more successfully in certain places than they do in others, for sure. I think there are certain tropes that don't get upended and just become tropes being depicted on screen, which maybe we'll get into later. The cinematography is absolutely phenomenal, and it's funny what you were just saying about having to pause and being able to pause on Netflix. It reminded me of Arrival, Denis Villeneuve, to him, where there were shots that were so extraordinary, you just wanted to pause the screen and just experience. It was like a painting. And there were moments in this film where it was just extraordinary. I mean, All Girl Canyon, the Tom Waits story, was just ridiculous. And that story was just essentially him and a pan for the entire story. Yeah. And he held it. And it wasn't just him and his performance, which was extraordinary. It was the scenery, the like cinematic scape behind him was just absolutely phenomenal. And that's one of the reasons why I feel you have to see it on the big screen, but also one of the benefits of having my laptop in front of me and just appreciating the art, because it is art in those moments.
Basically do both. Watch it and then watch it again. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's talk about that All Gold Canyon story.
Hello, Mr. Pocket.
We can all agree that that was it's right in the middle of the series of vignettes. And it's a beautiful thing. It's strange. I mean, a lot of work was clearly done on the screen, but it feels that special effects were often used to depict things in space or the impossible. This was to depict something that was impossibly beautiful. And I suppose the idea being that, you know, how green is my valley? And it was less green after he departed. And we won't necessarily spoil the plot, but clearly he's prospecting for gold. He does a little digging.
This is the Jack London one, actually.
It's quite carefully adapted
from a Jack London short story called All Gold Canyon. And it's about a sort of equilibrium with nature, or a deal in a way that this prospector is striking up with nature. There's a great little moment where he goes to try and steal some eggs out of an owl's nest and sees it watching. And then he decides he has to put them back, except maybe he'll take one and see if it doesn't notice. So there's this kind of bartering going on, which then kind of turns into a plot later on, I suppose. But what I like about the positioning of this episode is that it's the most verdant, it's the most pastoral, it's the most beautiful, but it comes after the bleakest one of the bunch, which is also really a two-character story. I like how the film, in general, the outer episodes of this film are quite ensemble-y and kind of busy. There's a lot of characters. And then we winnow ourselves down to these two in the middle, which are just like two-character stories. And that previous one, which is called Meal Ticket with Liam Neeson and Harry Melling, could not be more tonally different from All Gold Canyon. And having them juxtaposed like that is really effective to me. I think those are the best two. Actually, and yeah, I'll be watching those two again and again. I just rewatched those two this morning because I just wanted to kind of re-experience them.
Yeah, and they, as you say, they're wonderful back to back. Let's talk about Meal Ticket then. Liam Neeson in a very kind of gruff, quiet role as a sort of very, very small time out the back of a caravan impresario. Harry Melling plays this amazing legless and armless sort of a talking machine, I suppose. He's got that strange thing of being a little bit like Lord Charles somehow, and he's done up like that. He's almost like a ventriloquist dummy, which is a horrible thing to say, I suppose, for an afflicted young man, but an amazingly talented one. It's quite a spooky story, this one.
It is, and it is incredibly brutal, and it's actually my favourite of the entire six. It really, I mean, you know, there's lots going on in terms of the commodification in the entertainment industry, the kind of disposability that we see a lot with the bright new thing that comes along. It's just...
Which is far less good than the thing that came
that
before
came
it.
From, and actually maybe a bit of a con, ultimately, and maybe wasn't what you first thought it was. And I read some negativity about this online, which was about the kind of simplicity of it and the fact that you didn't really get much dialogue between the two of them.
It's strength, surely.
That, for me, is exactly what makes it. The simplicity is beautiful. The fact that their relationship is purely about the business. And he, you know, you see the kind of pressure that Liam Neeson's under, having to do everything for this boy who has no limbs at all. But actually it's worth it because he makes plenty of money and it's successful. And then as the crowd's dwindling, you feel the danger kind of looming before he decides, actually, this is no longer worth it.
And the snow's descending, the winds are coming in.
Yeah. And the changing vista that goes along with the changing fortunes you feel happening. The lack of kind of morality at certain points. And again, I don't want to spoil anything, but there is a real flippancy at moments, which in really profound profound events, there is an amazing flippancy that kind of really takes you aback. And that's where the Coens come into their own. Yeah. They are used to upending every convention, something that should be really quite shocking and really elegiac in many ways. It's just kind of 3 seconds on screen.
It's classic deadpan Coens. Every shot has weight. Every shot tells you exactly what it needs to tell you. And those performances are brilliant. And I think the fact that they do not exchange a single word throughout the entire... I don't think there's one word between them, which is amazing. It reminds me of a Beckett play.
I was going to say, exactly, it reminds me of Beckett. He looks so much like a Vladimir on Estragon, Liam
Neeson. Exactly, or it's like Endgame or something, where these two people... people are just stuck with each other and they've reached a point where they cannot communicate anymore. I think that is brilliant.
And it's not lucky, a sort of strange ventriloquist kind of thing in Weight of God.
And
Liam
Neeson's sort of face and teeth, he looks like a Beckett character as well. I think they've got that in mind. I think it's one of their best creations, this, and actually one of the best things they've ever done. I agree with Terry, it's my favourite of the lot. But I do then love the kind of afterglow of that episode going into All Gold Canyon and what Tom Waits is able to do to sort of pick us up out of the dirt, if you like, with his bare hands and shake his fists at the mountain and sort of say, no, goddammit, I'm gonna live. There's a real kind of life and death kind of juxtaposition there, I think, which is great.
Terry talked a little bit about, in Meal Ticket, about the idea of this the Harry Melling character. He's just called Artist, I think, in this story, who's quoting Shakespeare, the Gettysburg Address, Shelley. I mean, amazing stuff. A couple of fans were quite moving to listen to, and it's amazing stuff. And then, you know, being or his part of the act, you know, being superseded by a chicken pecking particular sounding gongs in the, and so this is it's an interesting thing about the morality of America moving west. There are obviously a lot of Comanches and Apaches and stuff in it as well, kind of making trouble for new prospectors and new settlers and things. Is there what's the moral universe of the Ballad of Buster Scruggs? Do you think each story, not heavy-handedly necessarily, but is pushing you towards an idea of, was it all, you know, here's how the West was won and where did it get us, kind of thing? I felt the light hand of morality on most of these stories.
I don't know. I think you can identify different moments of morality in each of the stories, and it does differ in each one. However, I think fundamentally, if you view it as a piece, which I think you should, I think it's about the futility of it all ultimately. I think we try and make sense of death. We try and make sense of what it means to be human. We try and make sense of what means success and what means failure. And the seemingly kind of random nature of life and death means that trying to put sense on this stuff is like trying to like build a statue out of sand. It's not going to work. And that is ultimately what I take away from it, is all we are left with is death and storytelling. And I think that is what the Coen's universe is
that goes
all
right
about.
Back to Blood Simple, right?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to Homer. I mean, you know, they adapted Homer in Oh Brother Where Art Thou, which actually I don't particularly like, but I really love this film, and I love the tone of it. I love exactly what you're saying, that it's about sort of hardship and bad luck and just sheer circumstance and drudgery and all these things. It's not stamping too much of a kind of good versus evil morality play at any point. In fact, there are not that many characters in it you would identify as either good or evil particularly.
They're just scrubbing along.
They're just desperate and scrubbing along, exactly.
Yeah.
I think it's all really brilliant. I also really love it as a bit of a corrective to the sort of heavy revisionist Western that we've tended to have lately, where filmmakers decide we have to retell the story of the West as it really was and write the balance and sort of make a film like Hostiles, which is kind of, you know exactly what it's going to say and it ends up saying it. This film, you don't know what's coming. And it's also, it's digging back into the old mythology and the old iconography and playing with it and giving it a little turn rather than dragging it to the present day and imposing kind of a new ideology on it. I like that.
I found that satisfying as well. And from the way that it played with its cliches, with the opening of the book and the colour plates and the fact that on Netflix, at least, you can pause it and look at some of the prose on the page and all the rest of it. I liked all that stuff. Terry, you talked about upending cliché, setting up a cliché and sometimes reveling in it and sometimes upending it. Let's talk about some of those things. There are stories we haven't talked about. Near Algodones, which is James Franco as a cowboy. This is a bit spaghetti westerny, I suppose. I don't know. This has got its fair share of kind of Comanches coming in for attack, as has The Girl Who Got Rattled, which is kind of feels kind of long, but has got a very satisfying ending to it as well. When we talk about clichés in this universe, which Western clichés are we talking about, I wonder?
I mean, there is a very obvious one which you just touched upon, which is kind of the racially charged stereotypes, you could say, around Native Americans, their position in this, you know, the yodeling savages who ride into view, butcher people and kind of ride off again without a second thought.
None of them have a personality apart from one in the James Franco one who has quite a laugh.
Yeah. But so it's interesting because I think it's something they've been faced with before in their work. And, you know, the arguments go that actually, do you do you actually depict it as it happened, as was the reality, as was believed to have happened at the time? Or do you take a revisionist view? I'm thinking of Westworld, who, you know, dedicated in the last season a whole episode to the central Native American character and produced one of the most nuanced and compelling depictions of those characters I've seen in modern TV or cinema. It is something that I found difficult and unsatisfying because I didn't feel that they played with that trope. I didn't feel like they upended it, subverted it. I think it served a function. And it kind of highlighted other tropes. So there's the damsel in distress, you know, who takes an action that maybe she didn't need to, as it turned out in the end. The kind of man who's there to save her, the tall, handsome stranger. There's all these kind of archetypes of characters circling this universe, so it isn't just the kind of the Native American archetype we're talking about, and it is used to highlight other tropes, but I find it unsatisfying that there wasn't more actually done to challenge that, to subvert that, to present a slightly different view, if not an entirely revisionist view.
Yeah, because there are lots of kind of storybooks for Western storybooks for boys that I'm sure my dad gave me that I remember reading as a kid, where there's a lot of Native American stories. There's a lot. It's even in those days, it wasn't just like the cowboys came in and fight. Phew, those savages got a beating. There wasn't even that completely kind of black and white ideology back then. I suppose you're right, Terry. It might have been nice to have seen that, or all would have been satisfying to see what those stories and those cliches would have, how they'd have been presented in a Coen universe. I suppose
from that, you know, could the Coens have told a story from the point of view of one of those characters?
Yeah.
Would there have been room for that within that universe, or were they the kind of caricatures and tropes they were using in each story, would it have thematically thrown the whole thing out of kilter? Quite possibly, right?
Because... yeah, I guess so. You know what? If I was going to do one little swap, it would be in the very first story, which is one that I don't particularly love. And the reason I don't love it is that I think Tim Blake Nelson is just a big old ham. And he comes riding in as a singing cowboy.
But he is
horse.
Meant to be.
He's such a massive ham. And I'm reminded of Brother Art there, which I kind of can't deal with.
All day I face the barren waste without the taste of water. Water.
Switch his character with a Native American. Have a singing Apache on a horse come in and do all the stuff he does in his story, and I would love that story. So I don't know, they missed a trick there, I think.
That is a great idea.
Nice bit of script editing from Mr. Roby there. Yeah. Thank you very much. That's a very good idea. I actually love that. I love the sort of singing detectiveness of that. I love the fact that the sort of he's the white rider and the black rider kind of comes across the plain playing wonderful or there is beautiful harmonica music that greets him, and then of course you see that he's playing it when he finally gets a close
everything.
Up. I loved all that sort of funny cinematic naffness.
I mean, I love all the naffness. I really kind of love everything about that episode, except that it's Tim Blake Nelson. That's just my one issue. So, yeah.
Poor old Tim Blake Nelson.
Sorry, Tim.
It's a Tim off.
He's not a good Tim.
<And he's>...
Let me tell you, buddy, there's a faster gun coming over yonder when tomorrow comes. Let me tell you, buddy, and it won't be long till you find yourself singing your last cowboy song.
I mean, the fantasy element in that story is just nuts. Like, it's brilliantly, brilliantly nuts. And, you know, and it plays with all of those kind of things around the senseless brutality. Anybody can get shot at any time, you know, including him. But there were moments in that which were, I just thought, absolute genius. Like, as a whole, I didn't think it was up there in the strongest, but the last 2 minutes for me were just absolutely remarkable.
Yes, some nice sort of Lebowski-ish dream sequences, yes, and things like that. And some amazing dialogue. I mean, obviously written in that kind of hokey Western kind of do-gooder kind of style, but it was some of the dialogue that he's got is absolutely fantastic in that. I wanted to, before we move on to our other topics of what this film reminded you of, I wanted to give our audience an idea of what this thing looks like. The Western is such a rich canon cinematically. In whose universe are we here? Are we in John Ford's universe? Are we in whereabouts are we? Are we in John Wayne's universe?
We're in a bunch of them, aren't we? I mean, yeah, we've already mentioned Spaghetti Westerns, which I think near Al Godona's, the James Franco one, is very Leone-ish in that way. Mm. I think that the All Gold Canyon feels like a John Ford film, feels like The Quiet Man or something like that. Not necessarily even a Western. It just feels like it has that John Fordian landscape thing going on. And then, I don't know, there's like a bit of Anthony Mann in there, I think, with these people kind of striving against the mountains. There are a lot of them. And in the final story, The Mortal Remains, I felt that there was more of a horror influence, really. Mm. We mentioned Tales of the Unexpected, but it has that sort of same kind of thing going on in Tarantino's The Hateful Eight, mm. where you yep. feel as though these people are in a purgatory, we're on the road to hell, essentially, which is, I think they borrow quite nicely from kind of horror stuff there. And just the way that the lighting changes in that section is really great. It just really does gradually darken and get more and more kind of garishly dark and purgatorial. The light coming in through the carriage, because about, you know, 20 minutes for that episode is just on a rattling carriage.
Yeah, that felt like sort of Sleepy Hollow written by Roald Dahl.
Yeah.
In a really nice
exactly.
way.
Or Stagecoach yeah. rewritten yeah. by Roald Dahl yeah. a la Sleepy Horror. Exactly, yeah.
Okay, beautiful stuff. Thank you both very much. We're going to turn now to the bit of the programme where we ask you kind of how you reviewed this, what it reminded you of. Tim, you wanted to talk about portmanteau films. Give us a bit of a flavour.
Yeah, this felt like a logical jumping off point. So, you know, filmmakers have always loved to tell multiple stories. Sometimes they want to do it themselves in the course of one film. So here we have the Coens making six in one. Sometimes they hand the baton between each other and you get films by multiple filmmakers. It's a risky game, though. And there are a lot of examples of portmanteau films which are extremely up and down, and which, you know, you struggle through one episode and then suddenly there's a gem and then there's another one that's not very good. It's rare to find one that really knits together. The thing I thought about this morning watching some of these was it reminded me of Creepshow, the George Romero-Stephen King yeah. collaboration from the 80s, which has a similar thing where between each of the episodes the kind of image turns to a kind of animated version of itself or a kind of cartoon version, and then we turn the page and it's a comic book. And we're kind of moving between comic book stories in that. And Creepshow works pretty well, I must say. That's one of the good ones. There are other great ones from in horror, especially from film history. There's Dead of Night from the 40s, which was the Ealing one, which is four stories by different filmmakers. And there's a particularly brilliant one in that with Michael Redgrave as a ventriloquist, which you can see a little bit of a parallel here, perhaps with Meal Ticket, I think.
A bit of Alfred Hitchcock Presents to this, right?
It's yeah,
a bit
exactly.
of kind of like you are almost, someone is sponsoring this and someone is giving you the kind of like artistic okay. And
yes.
then you enter a universe with their kind of pat on the back. Almost.
That's right, exactly. And in the 70s and 60s and 70s, there were the Hammer ones and there's the Amicus ones as well. And you usually have Peter Cushing as yeah. like an antiques dealer
Tick.
Who kind of pops up in between each of the stories
yeah.
and says, well, then there was this creepy mirror that I gave to someone and suddenly there's a story with a creepy
I
mirror.
Love stuff like
those
that.
Are good as well. Yeah. There's some really good ones. And the League of Gentlemen guys are obsessed with those and they're always referencing them and reusing the actors and stuff. So those are good. And then you have the sort of auteur follies which go a bit wrong or they go right and wrong. So there's New York Stories,
yeah.
which is the one that Woody Allen, Coppola and Martin Scorsese made in the late 80s, which has a brilliant Scorsese one and a really bad Coppola one and a sort of middling Woody Allen one. You know, it's yeah. it's a bit,
sounds
of,
about right.
bit of everything. Yeah.
yeah.
But the Scorsese life
guess
lessons.
The year.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, with Nick Nolte is tremendous
yeah.
And really, really, really good. So, yeah, I sort of always enjoy plunging into them.
Night on Earth by Jim Jarmusch.
Yeah, that's
true. Always love that. You're
absolutely.
Right, it's kind of uneven, but it's worth watching all of them to kind of get the picture.
Exactly, yeah.
But, yeah, that was the kind of one that presented itself to me as well, that kind
yeah.
of thing. Yeah, it's a funny one. I never know, in your estimation, do you think they're better when they're all by the same person?
That's more often the case.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's more often the case because you don't get those awful tonal shifts. If we choose The Nadir, it's probably Four Rooms, which was a
yeah.
film which cashed in a lot of Quentin Tarantino's cool in 1995 when he kind of collaborated with three other filmmakers. And his bit wasn't very good, but some of the others were even worse. And it was the moment of backlash.
There's the poster quote.
Yeah, exactly. It was just after Pulp Fiction that was when the backlash against Tarantino began because he did this slightly indulgent portmanteau, everyone gets a different room in the hotel deal,
yeah,
and it didn't work out.
You
so,
mentioned
yes.
Paris Je T'aime, which Coen Brothers did one of the, I don't know how many of those there were, but that was a bit like a Four Rooms type of thing. Right?
There's quite a lot of those. I think there might be 10 in that, are there? And there's also a New York one as well. They're very popular with kind of international Euro-pudding producers. You can kind of cobble together a portmanteau film and ask lots of directors to do
yeah.
just a little 10-minute bit. And sometimes they're really great, and sometimes they're just sort of like, why did we bother with this?
Feels like a film made of small kind of film commission incentives
yeah, exactly.
and tax breaks.
There's one about 9/11. Have you ever seen this one? It's called 11/9/01, and it's, I think it's 11 different films. And so Ken Loach does a 10-minute little documentary about how the other 9/11 was in 1973 during the Chilean coup, and he kind of explains that story, and he does his Ken Loach thing. And then other directors respond to 9/11 in different ways. There's a very abstract Iñárritu bit, and there's a really terrible Sean Penn one where Ernest Borgnine is this pensioner living in a squalid dark flat somewhere in Manhattan with no light coming in and dead plants on his windowsill, and suddenly the Twin Towers collapse and light floods his room and life is great. It's just like, really, Sean, what were you trying to say with this? So yeah, the risks are high with these names.
The back of a napkin that could well have been put in the washing machine. Happily. Yeah. So you're pointing people in the direction, I think, of Amicus, of Hammer.
Yes, Creepshow, Amicus. Yeah. The horror ones sort of tend to be the most fun, and you can forgive the odd dud one, because a dud horror can be quite fun anyway. You know, you sort of loll through it.
Yeah.
Yeah. A dud 9/11 episode is probably not so great.
It's a little... Yeah, exactly. It's difficult to suspend your irony and disbelief for something of that ilk, I suppose. Terry, you're changing direction slightly, and you want to talk about Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds' Murder Ballads. I love this record.
I love
Why
this
does it remind
record.
You of this, though?
I was actually saying, this came to me in a dream last night, so I don't want that to colour what I'm about to say or give it any less authority. But, you know, it for me, it has some fundamental similarities. So starting with the very concept, it's a macabre fable. It's essentially got an ensemble cast, if you think about PJ Harvey and Kylie Minogue. And it is a series of seemingly interconnected stories about how people die. And the tonal shifts in this record are one of my favourite things about it. So, you know, you go from Henry Lee with PJ Harvey, which the two of them are crooning all the way through, really delicately, really swoon-worthy. And it's about somebody who's been stabbed to death and dumped in a well. And you kind of, you're listening to it, and it's that classic thing of going, oh, did they just say stabbed to death and dumped in a well?
Relationship tips from PJ Harvey and Nick Cave there.
Yes.
What could possibly go wrong?
Maybe not the best if you know anything about their relationship history.
Come take him by his lily white hands. Come take him by his feet and throw him in this deep, deep well that's more than 100 feet.
Stagger Lee, which is much more violent and ferocious, right through to Kindness of Strangers, you know, where she's cuffed to a bed, but again, incredibly beautiful songwriting. I mean, I love this album, and people would call it a concept album, but for me, it's actually an anthology series set to music. And, you know, one of the things we didn't talk about with the Coens was the importance, actually, of music. And so for me, there's massive thematic, but also the structure of it, these standalone, and yet I always listen to that record from start to back. I never, ever dip in and out of that record. It's probably the only record in my collection of which that is true.
A concept album that's good.
Yes. Well, apart from Scream Medallica by Primal Scream.
Okay. Let's not go,
you know.
Do we hate Outside by David Bowie, which is another concept album about murder, isn't it? But
yeah.
I mean, bits of it are good.
Bits of it are good, yeah. I'm not going to mention ones I think are good. It's too embarrassing. So, but it is. It's a tough thing. I mean, I suppose with the obvious narrative of filmmaking or of a series of short stories, you can do this. It's less easy with music when people are listening with their ears rather than listening with... They're listening to music rather than listening to words.
Yeah.
I guess he did things like The Lyre of Orpheus, which still had this thing. He's done this on a few occasions and is a songwriter of such strength that I suppose he can do that, and the lyrics and the meaning stick in the head as much as something, is it?
And, you know, and it has this single image. Everything comes back to this pinpoint, which is the spectre of death. Mm. And whether it's murder or the death by the Coens, which actually was murder as well, pretty much in every occasion, that is the one thing he reverts to, whether it's a more loving murder, whether it's a more horrific murder, no matter the circumstance, that is the thematic concern that Nick Cave is concerned with on this album. And actually, it was relatively commercially successful at the time, which... blows my mind, because he dips in and out of between all of his kind of, whether it's Grinder Man, whether it's Bad Seeds, he moves between doing much more kind of straightforward commercial records and much more conceptual records. But the commitment to this and the people he brought into it, and I think it's the same with the Coens, I don't necessarily think James Franco, for example, in his story worked particularly well, even though it was one of my favourite stories. And Nick Cave was pulling Kylie Minogue, who at the time was a bubblegum pop star, and he completely moved her into a new space. So, yeah, I think this is probably the Bad Seeds' greatest work. And as soon as I dreamt this last night. I got up this morning and put this record on and I was like, I wish I could listen to this and watch the Coens at the same time.
Thank you both so very much for that. A lot of meat on the bones of Buster Scruggs. Hopefully our audience agreed. That brings us to the end of this week's show. The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is available to watch on Netflix now and has a limited release in cinemas too. Thanks to my guests today, Terry White and Tim Roby. And thanks to my producer, of course, Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time next week. But until then, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.